Could it be that the Democratic Party is not forever and for all time, as it is often understood to be, at least popularly, the pro-choice party? Could the issue of abortion cut both ways in both parties? You may have seen the commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, a point counterpoint, a pro-life Democrat and a pro-choice Republican going back and forth. I thought that was clever. We're going to be talking here in the first 20 minutes of the program with Roland Meinert. He is the pro-life Democrat in that point counterpoint in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch paper today. That'll be the first 20 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We are back live Tuesday. It's the 29th of March. A little bit of time off for the Easter holiday, and now we're back to work. In the middle of this first hour, Carl Olson, author of the book The Da Vinci Hoax, will join us. We're going to react to Maureen Dowd's column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch on the Da Vinci Code. She says, well, in the end, what Dan Brown purports to give to feminists, he takes away. We'll get some more general reactions to the Da Vinci Code in that second part of the first hour with Carl Olson. And then to round off the first hour of the program, Father Edward Richard will be our guest. As well as being an attorney, he is also a professor of medical ethics, associate professor of medical ethics at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis. He has but one of four opinions in the paper on medical ethics and Terry Schindler's Schiavo. As that story sadly continues, we will get his thoughts on that in the last part of this first hour of Issues Etc. Now in the second hour, a rare treat here in Studio A, joining us for an entire hour to make the legal case for Christianity, to explain to us what apologetics is and why it's important, Craig Parton of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. He is often with us for many years here on Issues Etc. via telephone. He'll be here in Studio A with us. He's going to be making some appearances, and I'll tell you about those in the course of these 3 hours of Issues Etc. as well. Then in the third hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. Last week it was, I think, Rick Warren, author of The Purpose-Driven Life, was on Larry King Live. The story that he was brought on to talk about was, of course, this shooting, Mr. Nichols, and the role that his book, or at least one chapter of his book, played in a hostage situation. We'll get a little bit from Rick Warren on that and some other subjects and your reactions, your questions and your comments in the third hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our first guest, Roland Meinert, is author of this commentary, at least one half of it, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's organizing a Missouri chapter of Democrats for Life. Roland, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Well, is the Democratic Party getting ready to turn the corner on the issue of life?
Well, it's very difficult to say. Either a lot of posturing is going on, or there are some fundamental changes taking place. I happen to think that there are some basic changes that are taking place, and as a result of the 2004 election, when what perhaps about 25% of the electorate indicated that they were making their voting choices on the basis of religion, values, ethics, morality, to me that was a very significant change, and it seems to me that Democratic leaders are now beginning to take that into account and think about it and realize that if the Democrats are ever to get back some of the major posts in this country, that they do have to change. So I guess my answer would be yes, I think there are some fundamental changes taking place.
How common is it in the voting booth for rock-ribbed, lifelong Democrats to cross party lines over the issue of abortion and to vote Republican instead of with their party?
How difficult is it?
How common is it?
Oh, how common is it? Oh, I think it was very common. I don't have any national data on this. I can only go by my own family. We've been Democrats since the Depression, since the time of Social Security. And it was considered almost to be a sin to vote Republican. In this last election, I would think that of family members that I've talked to that have been lifelong Democrats, fully half of them went over and voted Republican, both for the governor's race in Missouri and for the the presidential race.
Over the issue of abortion and other life issues?
Yes, absolutely.
How difficult? You did bring that up just a second ago. How difficult is that to do?
To move over?
Yes.
And to give up this lifelong affiliation with the Democratic Party?
Yeah.
For some, I don't think it was difficult at all. I think the pro-life issues, particularly abortion, are the central issue for them, and they would put into the background all other considerations. So I think for some it was fairly easy to do that.
Now, how would you respond to someone who says what we are seeing here post-November 2004 is mere political posturing on the part of prominent Democrats when it comes to the life issue, the talk of common ground, the talk of reducing the number of abortions? How would you respond to someone who says all that is just expedient politics, rhetoric, nothing more?
Well, in the last couple of months, as I indicated in the commentary, all of a sudden, pro-choice Democrats at the national level, Hillary Rodham Clinton and Charles Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and Howard Dean, began to make statements in public that were pro-life friendly. And I don't remember the actual conference that Hillary Clinton was at, but it was somewhere in New York where she was addressing what was primarily a pro-choice group, and she began to talk about the need to reduce the number of abortions in the country and to look at alternatives. And I think from the news account that I read, the audience was stunned when she began to make statements like that. When they were looking for people to step forward to chair the Democratic National Committee, one who was under serious consideration was the former congressman from Indiana, Tim Romer, and Nancy Pelosi, who is the leader in the House, supported him. Charles Schumer, who is a strong pro-choice person in the Senate, supported him. That would have never happened before. And now yet, I also see, I can't give you all the states where this is happening, but there are many states where pro-choice candidates and pro-life candidates are beginning to campaign, and others are beginning to support the pro-life candidate over the pro-choice candidate, the Democratic Party. That would not have happened before.
All right. Let's deal with the chairmanship of the DNC first, because, of course, Tim Romer was in the running, and he was talked about an awful lot. And there was some support expressed for him in advance of that election. And yet it was former Governor Howard Dean who finally got the post, and he is no pro-lifer by any stretch of the imagination.
But he has also made pro-life-friendly comments. Again, I can't quote you exactly what he said, but he has generally talked about the necessity for the Democratic Party to reach out, to recognize diversity, to recognize that there are differences, and to bring all Democrats back under the big tent. So, to some extent, he has changed his tune from the time when he was a candidate for the presidency.
So, I guess this is what I'm wondering, because I'm watching this with a fair measure of skepticism, to be quite honest with you, Roland.
Yes.
And I'm saying to myself, what is the real position that would change if a position is going to change? And I guess it's abortion on demand, no ifs, ands, or buts, maybe typified by the state in which I live, Illinois, no parental consent. No parental notification. Cross state lines with minors if you want to. We will not put any roadblock in your way to have abortion when you want it, where you want it, and as often as you want it. Now, that may be overstating the case of the pro-choicers in there, in the Democratic Party, but that's an absolutist position. And anything short of that, some are going to see as infringing upon the quote-unquote right granted by Roe v. Wade.
Well, I don't know how, you know, I don't know how to answer that, actually. I do believe that it will be possible that there will be people in both camps, the pro-life camp and the pro-choice camp, that will agree and see that abortion is not a social good, if you will, and therefore will support explorations to look at alternatives that would reduce the number of abortions. Now, you're right. This is really going to be very tricky because there are people who are going to say that pro-life Democrats want to take away the woman a woman's right to choose, and there is a hidden agenda in all of this. My own position is I do think that there are people of goodwill on both sides that, as I said, do not see abortion as a social good, and will support looking at ways in which they can be reduced without challenging the essential core belief of both sides. On one side, the pro-life side, there is agreement that life begins at conception. Now, you are not going to convince persons who are pro-choice that is the case. On the other hand, you are not going to convince people in the pro-choice camp to give up that particular philosophy, if you will. So I'm not saying that there's going to be basic changes in philosophy and ideology on both sides, but I do think that they can come to some agreement about the need to reduce the number of abortions and engage in some civil discourse about it.
Is the pro-choice position compatible with true Democratic Party ideals, as you have known them, you say, your whole life?
Well, is the pro-choice...
Yeah, is the pro-choice position compatible with true Democratic Party ideals?
I would say no, because it strikes me that it is not consistent with the notion of social justice that's been espoused by the Democratic Party for decades.
And to what degree is money going to play a part in this? You have mentioned that there has been some support beginning for pro-life Democratic candidates here and there. And yet it has kind of become the rule of thumb, Roland, that if you want to rise, especially to the national level and prominence in the party, there have been a lot of prominent flip-flops
right.
from pro-life to pro-choice, because that's following the money.
That's a very good question and very insightful. I think the reason that pro-life candidates lost over the last several decades is when they came up against pro-choice candidates, They were not supported monetarily, whereas pro-choice candidates were. Now, the issue is, are people going to financially support pro-life candidates? I don't know the answer to that. I think that they will, and I think that they will hearken back to the last national election in 04, when those 25% of the electorate voted for, as we said, moral, religious, and other reasons. I think there are some beginning indications that pro-life Democrats will be supported with campaign funds.
It sounds as though you're saying, Roland, that this is really not a matter of if, but a matter of when. That sooner or later, the political gravity, the gravity of the voter, is going to push the Democratic Party, if it's going to survive in its present form, toward the pro-life position than it's been in the last three decades.
Yes, absolutely. And as I said, those people that have begin speaking out in pro-life friendly ways, I think are symptomatic of what's beginning to take place. I had a very long discussion with Jeff Harris, who is the minority leader in the House, about this issue. And Jeff is a pro-choice person, but he, as the leader of the Democrats in Missouri, he is saying we want all points of view to be openly discussed, to be given consideration, and I do agree. I'm speaking for him now. I hope I'm not misquoting him. I do agree that we would like to reduce the number of abortions in Missouri. So, I begin to see signs all over the place that, to go back to your original question, is there real change beginning to take place, or is all of this political posturing? I think that some fundamental changes are beginning to take place.
How can our listeners find out about this newly minted Missouri chapter of Democrats for Life?
Well, I guess the best way would be to email me. We're in the initial stages of trying to get up and running. I've gotten inquiries from perhaps 25 people from throughout the state, but I could give you my email address, and that would be the best way. And then I would get in touch back with people who got in touch with me.
Go right ahead there, if you would, Roland.
And the email address is R.G. Meinert, M-E-I-N-E-R-T, @AOL.com.
Very good, very good. Thank you very much for being our guest, and Godspeed on the founding of the Missouri chapter of Democrats for Life. And I hope that your hopes for the Democratic Party in the future actually come true. Thank you for being our guest.
Okay, I hope to be a Democrat for life.
Roland Meinert is author of St. Louis Post-Dispatch commentary, Pro-Life Democrats versus Pro-Choice Republicans, and he's organizing a Missouri chapter of Democrats for Life. Again, his email address, if you're interested in finding out more, R.G. Meinert, that's M-E-I-N-E-R-T, @AOL.com. R.G. Meinert, @AOL.com. Here in the middle of the hour, lapping over this bottom of the hour break, Carl Olson joins us. Maureen Dowd wrote a column for today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, appeared nationally on the Da Vinci Code. We're going to get his reaction to that here in the middle of the hour and talk about the Da Vinci Code in general as well. He has written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Gnostic Nonsense. He's editor of IgnatiusInsight.com. Carl Olson, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, Maureen Dowd says that in the end, Dan Brown's book has been touted as a boon for feminists, restoring the true nature of Christianity, takes away what it purports to give, and it ends up with the old patriarchy, the old women living silently and in submission. Would you agree with her assessment there of Dan Brown's bestseller?
No, I don't. I think she's made a serious error there, and I think that she basically is trying to be very clever, which I think is really how Maureen Dowd approaches most of her writing, as she attempts to be clever without really giving a lot of substance. And she makes the claim that at the end of the Da Vinci Code that, in fact, everything is set right and that the women quietly buckle under and allow the nasty male-dominated church to continue on. And I point out in a recent blog on the blog that I am on, Insight Scoop, that, in fact, at the end of the novel, what you have is really a reaffirmation of the whole point of the novel, which is this very pro-radical feminist, anti-Christian, anti-Catholic Church agenda. And even though it does a soft sell, it still comes through loud and clear. And I think that readers' reaction to the novel bears that out very well.
There have been some official responses to Dan Brown's novel, as far up as Vatican officials. And Maureen Dowd says this is kind of funny, because they're reacting to stuff that's fictional. And why are they spending so much time reacting quickly, she says, for the Vatican, to things that are just pure fiction?
Well, I just wrote an article called the Just Fiction, It's Just Fiction Doctrine, because this is the number one response that I get. I co-authored a book called The Da Vinci Hoax, where my co-author and I go through and examine the phenomenon of the Da Vinci Code and go through all the historical errors. And we also talk about this claim that, well, it's just fiction. Why do you take it seriously? Well, the number one reason, frankly, is because there's millions of readers who are taking it seriously. All you have to do is spend 10 minutes on the Internet, go to Amazon.com, go to discussion forums, et cetera, and you'll find that readers are enthralled not by the plot, not by the characters of the Da Vinci Code, but by the historical claims. And there are numerous claims made of the Da Vinci Code, almost all of them erroneous or wildly skewed, and people are fascinated by it, whether it be the claim that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, or the Emperor Constantine basically deified Jesus in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. The list goes on and on and on. So there has been an overwhelmingly positive reaction to the Da Vinci Code. It's now sold 25 million copies. People are enamored by the historical claims, the message, which a large part of that is very anti-Christian. So I think that's why it has to be taken very seriously. My position is there is no such thing as just fiction. There's good fiction and bad fiction. And the Da Vinci Code is bad fiction, both from the standpoint of content and style, but the fact is it's having a tremendous influence on a lot of readers who are taking it as gospel truth.
Now, you have written this, and I think this is very clever. You're as clever as Maureen Dowd, in my opinion. But you say The Da Vinci Code's success is the novel's insistence that the author and the sympathetic readers not only know better, they're in on the secret, but they are better. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there's this arrogance about people who are obsessed with the Da Vinci Code, and certainly I think an arrogance that comes through from the author himself, Dan Brown, although he's been staying out of public view for quite a while now. And this arrogance is on one hand, it's kind of an intellectual arrogance, which is, well, I know the true story about the origins of Christianity. I know what really happened with Jesus and Mary Magdalene. I know what the church has tried to hide all these centuries from the poor, unwashed masses of people who go along with superstitious beliefs, etc. So there's really this intellectual arrogance, and it really comes from a form of neo-Gnosticism. Of course, Gnosticism, which I talk about throughout this article, is that ancient heresy which asserts that only an elite few are going to understand the truth about salvation. And so that comes through, I think, in the Da Vinci Code, which is that if you read this novel, and also not just in the Da Vinci Code, but also the phenomena surrounding it, all the media and attention, that if you read this novel, somehow you have an inside knowledge, a secret elite knowledge that's been given to you. Of course, now 25 million people have that supposedly secret knowledge, so I guess the elitism of it is starting to dissipate. But that's part of what I'm talking about there.
So there's an appeal to secret knowledge. Is there also an appeal to, well, whatever it is that appeals about a conspiracy theory as grand and as large in scope as Dan Brown at least purports to have found and uncovered in the church?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Americans, I think, love conspiracy theories. Now, a lot of Americans love conspiracy theories just as kind of a form of entertainment. You know, for instance, I think of the X-Files, the really popular TV series back in the 90s, which I actually enjoyed. Of course, didn't take it very seriously as far as factual basis. But Americans have always been enamored to a certain degree with conspiracy theories. And I think in the case where at the heart of the conspiracy theory is this institution, the Catholic Church, and that really is the bad guy in the novel, I think that really resonates with Americans for a number of reasons. Certainly, the recent sex scandals within the Catholic Church in America are part of that, but also the fact that Americans in general, speaking generally, don't seem to like what they call organized religion. A lot of people more and more will talk about being spiritual but not religious, or how they find God out in nature or in some kind of unorganized setting. Maybe they borrow something from Buddhism, they borrow something from Hinduism, etc. So I think there's that bias against what is seen as a very traditional, uptight, highly structured organization, which really misses the whole point of what the church is about, unfortunately.
We'll talk more about that and about the creeping Gnosticism behind Dan Brown's best-selling novel, The Da Vinci Code, with Carl Olson on the other side of this break. He's editor of IgnatiusInsight.com, co-author of the book, The Da Vinci Hoax, and he has also written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Gnostic Nonsense. Then, to round off this first hour of the program, Father Edward Richard will be our guest. He's an attorney and associate professor of medical ethics at Kendrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis, and he's authored a commentary on the Schiavo case, Terry Schindler Schiavo, in Sunday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. That'll round off the first hour of Issues, Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
You are one who has lived in rebellion against him. You have treated him as if he wasn't there, as if you had gotten rid of him. Sin ultimately is the attempt to murder God and get rid of him and put yourself in his place. We are unmistakably sinners, and there's no hope for us except if we're not going to answer for our sins, the only hope is that somebody else would.
In good preaching, the sternness of the law is always answered by the sweetness of the gospel. You'll find the solid preaching of both law and gospel in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, Selected Sermons of Dr. Norman Nagel. The book is $24.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org.
A veterinarian who can keep animals healthy has a special connection to people who own the livestock. This Global Minute takes a look at people who treat animals and share Christ with their owners. Daniel and Krista were two pre-vet students who traveled to the African country of Uganda and helped a longtime missionary vet serving with Christian Veterinary Mission. Krista described the animals they treated as the people's currency, stock market, banks, and 401k plans. Families measure their wealth by how many animals they own, so keeping the livestock healthy earns a veterinarian a special trust, which opens the door to sharing Christ's love. Pray more Christians with veterinary skills will serve in cultures where men and women have yet to hear about Christ. Discover ways to use the talents God has blessed you with for His glory on the mission field by exploring missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. How is it where you live? At home in southern Illinois, I'm now waking up to hear the birds singing. I no longer have to bundle up to go outside and get the newspaper. Forsythias and daffodils are in full bloom. The tulips will soon be coming. Bare branches of trees are beginning to show some hints of what is to come. Soon the lawnmowers will be starting up again, people working in their yards. Exercise amateurs have come out of winter hibernation and are trying to walk off, or jog off, or bicycle off the pounds of winter. Good luck! Genesis chapter 1 tells how God created this wondrous world of nature that now is springing into bloom. Then Genesis 2 verse 2 says, "On the seventh day God rested from all His work." What did God do on that day of rest? He enjoyed His creation. It was so very good. I hope you can take some time these days to enjoy His handiwork. After all, that's exactly what He did. All creatures that have breath and motion, that throng the earth, the sea, the sky, now join me in my heart's devotion. Help me to raise God's praises high. My utmost powers can never quite declare the wonders of His might. Thanks for listening. I'm Dale Meyer, and enjoy this wonderful spring.
Have you tried and failed to live a purpose-driven life? Do your attempts to live a life that is pleasing to God fall so far short that you'd rather stay home from church? Then join Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, where the focus isn't on you, but on Christ, who was made sin for you so that you might become the righteousness of God in Him. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. Their phone number, 618-539-5664. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the exaltation of Christ. We talked about the humiliation of Christ last week with Dr. Stephen Hine. Well, the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel, will be our guest tomorrow to talk about the exaltation of Christ. It begins with that descent into hell. And it is still underway. And really has yet one thing left on the agenda before it is complete. And that is Christ's glorious return and the raising of the dead and the judging of the living and the dead. We'll talk about it tomorrow on Issues Etc. Dr. Carl Olson is our guest. We're talking about the Da Vinci Code. He has written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Gnostic Nonsense. Carl, you mentioned before the break that this is a form of Gnosticism. You talked about that ancient heresy. So what's the appeal of Gnosticism to people who may only be passingly familiar with Christianity itself? It seems to me that Dan Brown's novel is probably 50-50 popular, 50% popular among Christians, 50% popular among people who may be either nominal or non-Christian.
I think the appeal of Gnosticism is, one, it's rather ambiguous character in that it takes language that people are familiar with, especially the language of Christianity. That was true of the ancient Gnostics. I think it's true of certain Gnostic movements today, neo-Gnostic movements. It takes language that people are familiar with, or people such as Jesus, Mary Magdalene, etc., and then reforms them, reshapes them, and puts them in a new context and has them say things that are more appealing to people, especially people who don't want to hear about things such as the cross, suffering, sin, salvation, but want to be told that they actually are the ones who can kind of create their own salvation. They can also, in a sense, create their own reality. I think that in the end, that's one of the things that Da Vinci Code does in this neo-Gnostic fashion. It says that readers are really free to create their own reality and their own truth and their own spirituality. And, you know, the Da Vinci Code is kind enough to help them along by offering some clues, namely to worship goddesses, particularly the goddess of Mary Magdalene. But really, the key thing is to reject this authoritarian dogmatic religion known as Christianity and to create your own truth based on your needs. And I think that is at the heart of the ongoing appeal of Gnosticism and all of its different offshoots.
So then we're back to where we began, it sounds like, Carl. It sounds like the line between truth and fiction gets blurred, not only in the novel, but if you follow Dan Brown's prescription for how spirituality ought to proceed, just because I make it up as I go along doesn't mean it isn't true. And if you make something else up as you go along, it's equally true.
Right, and I think this is one of the things about Gnosticism, both ancient forms of Gnosticism and more modern forms, that makes it extremely potent and dangerous, in that it doesn't try to directly destroy Christianity. Instead, it kind of assimilates it. It assimilates its language and some of its features, and then, like a virus, it comes into the host and destroys the truth and the reality of that belief system. And that's really what happens, is that people say, well, I believe in Jesus, but then when you start talking to them, it turns out they don't believe in a Jesus who was the second person of the Trinity, who became man, who suffered, died on the cross, etc. They believe in some kind of enlightened teacher who came and had a nice message and encouraged them to be good to others and to follow their own path to truth. And this is really how Gnostic elements work. They don't directly assault, usually. They assimilate and then kind of destroy from within.
Now, you talk about a recent public talk that Dan Brown gave, well, it was about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, at the height of his novel's popularity, and that the women outnumbered the men about 5-1. What does this tell you about Dan Brown's ideas in the novel?
They definitely are appealing to huge segments of the female population, and it's, you know, of course, it's really difficult to get an exact beat on that. I don't know that anybody's done any exact polling research, but it's very clear that the vast majority of readers of the Da Vinci Code are women, and that's based on the fact that women read more books, period. But also, you know, I've been traveling quite a bit talking about this and other topics, and when I'm in airports or on airplanes, I see people reading, and I would say that, again, it's 4-1, 5-1 women who are reading this novel, just based on kind of anecdotal observance. It's the novel's insistence that women have gotten this short end of the stick, and that Christianity is this really a woman-hating, nasty religion, and that the world won't be restored to peacefulness and truth and wonderfulness until people worship gods and goddesses equally, that there's a balance, and that this what the novel describes as the sacred feminine is restored. And one of the ironies of the novel, and this is kind of echoing something that Frank Peretti said many years ago, is that everybody in the novel gets to be a god or goddess if they choose, except for Jesus, yeah, who remains just a mere mortal prophet who remains trapped in time, whereas everybody else can become a god or goddess. And I think that's part of the whole idea here as well, is that Jesus gets conveniently stuck in the past, and everybody else gets to attain some kind of spiritual enlightenment.
Finally, Carl, with only a minute, Maureen Dowd says that the message from Christendom officialdom is, don't read it, don't buy it. Is that the message?
Well, no, I think that the message from Cardinal Bertone, who spoke out on it, and the message that I give people is, unless you have a really good reason to read the Da Vinci Code, namely to combat its errors and to engage in helpful dialogue, it's really not worth reading. It's lousy fiction. Its content is lousy. Life is too short for mediocre fiction. But if you need to combat it, to talk with friends or family members who are being sucked into it, then I think that's a good reason to read it. But certainly, Catholic bookstores, Christian bookstores shouldn't be selling the Da Vinci Code. I think that's kind of cutting your own throat in a real sense, and this is giving into an anti-Christian reality in doing so.
Carl Olson is editor of IgnatiusInsight.com. He's co-author of the book, The Da Vinci Hoax, and he's written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Gnostic Nonsense. Carl, thank you for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it.
Now, for the remainder of this hour, we're back into the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. There was a Sunday set of commentary side by side. A hospice nurse, a Christian minister, a Catholic priest, an ethics professor. The Catholic priest, Father Edward Richard, joins us here in the last part of this first hour to talk about medical ethics and Terry Schindler-Schiavo. He's an attorney and associate professor of medical ethics at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis and author of part of this commentary on the Schiavo case in Sunday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Father Richard, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be with you.
Your thoughts here on this day where, and we're talking about the waning days, apparently, for Terry Schindler-Schiavo.
Yes, it seems that way.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I was mostly sad. I've given a lot of time reflecting upon this in the last few days and realizing that there's not a lot I can do to change the situation, to change the outcome of this. But I hope in some way that this begins to open up people's eyes as to what is happening and what has happened in our country with respect to the way that the medical culture and our law has subordinated the dignity of the human person to their own processes.
Now, this term comes up again and again in your commentary in the Post-Dispatch. And it sounds like you're trying to steer this term back in the direction of protecting not only Terry Schindler-Schiavo, but helpless life in general, death with dignity. What does it mean in modern parlance, as we hear it bandied about in the Schiavo case? What ought it mean?
Well, obviously, in modern parlance, it's referring primarily, I think, to a sort of euthanistic kind of idea that there's some sort of good death out there and that everyone can choose the way they want to die. But what we ought to be thinking about is, as I tried to begin this reflection, of course you could do it in many ways from the Christian perspective, but just on the importance of the fact that the human person made in the image and likeness of God is a person with a body and soul unity, and that our Lord himself rose in his human body from the dead, and that our life as persons in and through our body is something to be preserved. Now, obviously, we have a responsibility to conserve our own life. There are certain kinds of excuses that could come up that we don't have to do that, and we talk about that in terms of extraordinary things that we don't have to do to combat diseases or things that afflict us. But we human beings are made to live in a body, and the resurrection points us in the direction of that ageless and glorified body that the Christ's victory over death has won for us. And we as human beings are subject to God, who is the author of life, and it's his prerogative to decide on life and death, and not ours. Consequently, we cannot do some action that directly brings about death. And therefore, to do that with respect to an innocent person, in no case can that be death with dignity. That must be avoided.
One of your fellow commentators in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, differing radically from your position, obviously, seems hardly willing to forward the term life when it comes to Terry Schindler-Schiavo. He writes this: what does constitute protecting life when a person is almost total certainty of no recovery, no consciousness, and is sustained entirely artificially? What life would one be protecting? How would you answer those one by one, beginning with certainly no prospect of recovery?
Well, of course, that itself is highly debatable, and we've seen the experts in this case, we've seen a number of people challenge that. Number one, just on the issue of recovery, again, I will go back to one of the points that I've tried to highlight in this case, is that human beings are not guinea pigs for medicine. the priorities in medicine should be the priority of persons over things. And we human beings, as long as we are alive in our human body, we are subject, or we are persons with dignity, and we can't be just dismissed by medicine because medicine hasn't taken the trouble, or the medical culture hasn't taken the trouble to try to have a better outcome. In other words, it seems to me that the medical culture is saying, well, we don't have the means, we don't have enough time, we don't have enough resources, we don't have enough money to bring these people back to where they were before, and therefore, at a certain point, whatever this arbitrary level is, we're just not going to deal with it.
But even if Terry Schindler-Schreiber could be shown beyond a shadow of a doubt to everyone's satisfaction to have absolutely no prospect of recovery, would the no prospect of recovery mean that she does not deserve to be protected?
Not at all. Not at all. I was simply referring to this idea. I mean,
sure.
Which is, you know, it's like, again, self-fulfilling prophecy for them. But no, if you have a living human being who is continuing to live on her own, she's not terminal, she's not dying, she deserves basic human care, the minimal means of keeping her alive, and taking care of her person in and through her body, caring for her. And I mean, in this case, though, it's so obvious that she responded to care. So,
what about this notion that feeding and hydrating Terry Schindler-Schreiber is, in the words of the one commentator, having her sustained entirely artificially?
Well, again, there are so many things that are assumed in that kind of a statement. First of all, the person who said that knows that we do this all the time. We do this for all kinds of people. The issue is not whether or not we're giving them food and water through a tube or any other way. The issue is that they don't believe that her life is worthy of receiving that. But the person who said that knows that day in and day out in medical institutions around the world, people are receiving that for whatever reason. Maybe for a period of time they can't receive, they can't swallow on their own, or that's just the way some people live. Some people have diseases that's the way they go through life. But the person who said that is simply incorporating into that statement the idea that we don't think that she is a person worthy of this kind of treatment or care.
The term vegetative state or persistent or permanent vegetative state is now become, well, a household term, hasn't it? In at least the last 11 days, if you've been following it, maybe in the last several months.
Mm-hmm.
What does this term do to the way we think about human life?
Well, as I said in the commentary, it's undignified. It's below human dignity to refer to any living human being as a vegetable or some form of a plant. And it is simply a hypothesis. There's no clear demarcation, although the Neurological Society and others have certain criteria for determining this. But if, as in our medical culture in the United States, we're not going to give appropriate forms of treatment, and we're simply going to use that as a catchphrase for saying, well, this person isn't going to recover, there's nothing we can do, and that's the end of it, then it just becomes a death sentence for those who are taking off food and water.
What needs to change? If you could name three things, the way we think, our laws, and perhaps maybe even something in the structure of how these decisions are made. I'm thinking about the degree to which the courts have given Michael Schiavo a pass on so many areas and allowed him to remain the guardian here. What needs to change in those areas, the way we think?
Well, the first thing I think is that from the standpoint of, well, we could make it a two-point thing. Number one, just from the standpoint of society, our society needs to do a lot of soul-searching about who we think we really are in terms of the way we care for the weakest among us. But from the Christian perspective, I think people need to search deeply into the meaning of creation of the human person and the resurrection of the body, and understand that human beings, from the biblical perspective, are a unity of body and soul. And that if you have a living human being, we need to be completely convinced here that a human being in their body is worthy of being protected. The second thing, it seems to me, is that the law is going to have to deal with a couple of things. Number one, eventually we're not going to be able to avoid the question of human personhood anymore, and we're going to have to deal with that because, I mean, from embryos to euthanasia, we've got this situation out there. But in terms of the guardianship and the protectorship of these vulnerable people, the law cannot maintain its integrity and exclude certain people from these decisions as if they didn't exist. The hypocritical thing about a case like this is that the law, on the basis of adultery or any other kind of thing, you could walk into court any day and get a divorce, and yet the guardianship question would be totally out the window. But in this case, the law has adamantly stuck to the idea that her husband, Michael, is definitely on her side and doing this in her best interest. Well, that's just hypocrisy to the max. And the third thing, I think, is it's very important for people in the medical profession to understand that when they treat someone, they're not simply treating biology. Medical doctors who treat human beings are treating human beings, not just animals that have, just because we have a biology similar to human to other animals, doesn't mean that we are not that we're just like them. No, we are spiritual and physical, and we're spiritual persons in and through our bodies. And if you have a living human being there, you are looking at something that God, a person that God has made to image Him.
All right. Respond, if you would, to this, and I'm quoting from one of your fellow commentators in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch's fourfold treatment of the Schiavo case on Sunday, and I quote here, "The irony is, of course, that as much as we talk about life, it is actually the fear of death and the denial of death that is at work. If we sincerely trusted in the graceful future of God, we would not be driven to go to such lengths to both postpone the dying and as a correlate, extend suffering. Remember, Jesus came off the cross. It didn't go on forever. Doesn't Terry Schiavo deserve at least that?" How would you respond?
Well, the argument that's being made there is overly broad because you can use that argument for any number of justifications for ending life. I mean, a Kevorkian-like person could do the same thing. I'm just doing these persons a favor. This is the kind of mentality that was adopted in the Netherlands. You know, the Dutch doctors who, even though involuntary euthanasia was not legal, they said, well, you know, I'm in order to help this person in a compassionate way, I wouldn't want to live that way, and most people wouldn't want to live that way, so we're just going to let them go on to their just reward, and we'll help them do that. So the argument there is just overly broad. The issue is not whether or not one fears death, or whether or not, rather the issue here is that is a question of, do we have a human being there that we should be responsible for giving the basic minimal care to in a way that's appropriate to their condition and in a way that's non-discriminatory against someone who has a severe disability? And that's what they're not willing to face.
Finally here, Father Richard, are we going to have to face up to the fact that the case for the human person, both of those terms, human and person, is an uphill battle, that we are living, as Wesley Smith says, in a culture of death, and sad but true, the burden of proof has been unfairly shifted to those who want to protect life?
Yes, well, on that I agree entirely with Wesley Smith. Yes, the burden of proof has shifted to those who want to protect the life of the innocent.
So how do we take up that burden and with only a minute here, make the case that we're dealing here with Terry Schindler Schiavo with a disabled human person.
Yeah. Well, I will speak particularly to the Christians in this. I believe we have a gift to offer because God has revealed to us the special and sacred dignity of each human person. So we carry within our hearts the revelation of the gift of who we are as human persons and the special privilege and protection and love that God has shown us through his Son. And I think that's what it's going to take to change the hearts of people again, to bring them back to understand the sacred dignity of the human person. It's not that it can't be done philosophically, but we as Christians have all of that and more in the manifestation of God in the Word incarnate.
How much of a turning point is this in the at least the American thinking about this and acting about this, both the arguments for Terry Schindler Schiavo's death and the arguments against her death have been probably more heard in the last week to 10 days than any other issue. This has garnered more attention than any other case, like it or unlike it.
And I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Well, where are we? Are we at a point where are we at this turning point where people are saying, look at all those supporters down there for Terry Schindler Schiavo. We're going to win this one, even if Terry herself loses the battle.
Well, Todd, it looks to me like rather than anybody necessarily reexamining their positions, that there's just some crystallization, which in itself could be beneficial for those who want to crystallize their arguments in favor of life. But it seems to me that a lot of people are just going to be looking at ways also of making sure that they can end their life. I think, you know, euthanasia is a lot more prevalent and acceptable to our society than most people realize. It's been around for a long time, and it's been part of our culture for a long time. We just, you know, we've just managed to, we had so many protections in the law, which are now disappearing, that people haven't been able to do it.
Father Edward Richard, thank you very much for being our guest.
It's been a pleasure.
Father Edward Richard is an attorney and associate professor of medical ethics at Kenrin Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis, and he's authored a commentary. You can find it in St. Louis Post-Dispatch Sunday edition. All four of these commentaries, including that by Father Richard, stltoday.com, stltoday.com. When we come back from this break, live here in Studio A, Craig Parton, a longtime and regular guest here on Issues Etc., is in the St. Louis area. He's going to be doing some presentations, both here at the seminary and, let's see, I think he's already done one yesterday at Washington University. We'll be talking with him about the legal case for Christianity and the apologetic task. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.